You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. It's Thursday, and you're hearing that music. It's time for the Lynch Kenny event. Joining me from Texas is Tim Lynch. Timmy, how you doing?
Doing fine, Mac. Thanks for having me on again.
You bet. And from Southern California, right down the road, Jeff Kenny. Jeff, what's going on?
Good. Everything's good, Mac. Good to hear from you guys.
All right. We have some unfinished business. A week ago, Timmy and I were talking when we got off, and I kind of teased that Timmy would tell the O-Doc Lynch story. So, for those of you who didn't hear last week, if you didn't hear last week, go find the end of last week's podcast. But Timmy tells a story about going to OCS, and they find out he's a corpsman, and then they find out that his dad's a general. I remember the first time he told the story, I almost pissed my pants. I was laughing so hard because Timmy tells it funny. So, Timmy, let me get out of the way and you tell the old Doc Lynch story.
Okay. Well, yeah, I got to set it up a little bit. I went to OCS exactly 2 years after you. It was October 85.
Yeah.
And it... OCS, the candidates, they arrive on a Sunday afternoon. It's a very low stress reception. Some even have their parents and the staff, the officers of the OCS are there. They have like a little reception and they see off the parents and then they quietly usher you out and shave your head and issue you some gear. And that's when it starts getting a little bit of pressure as you're marching over this bridge because you're carrying more gear than you possibly can. And these Marines with the campaign hats are hurrying you up. And they get you in the barracks, and then they read a bunch of stuff to you about what they can and can't do, to include using foul language. And then I remember the senior instructor, because that's what you call them. They'll call them DIs. Senior instructor, Staff Sergeant Gerard, said, a sergeant instructor, Staff Sergeant Taylor, will now introduce himself to you. And he went up and down, because you're in a squad bay, standing in front of your racks, went up and down in front of it, the face of every Marine, and screamed, "Fuck you, candidate, I hate your guts, I'm going to run you out of my Marine Corps," right? And then, so he went all the way around, and then stopped, and of course you're looking, and everybody's wondering what the heck's going on here, and then Senior Sergeant Instructor, Staff Sergeant Gerard said, "Where is Doc Lynch?" Everybody's looking, and I said, here's Staff Sergeant. Which got, you know, the other sergeant instructor screaming at him, but Dry holds him off. He walks up. He goes, "Hey, Doc, I got a little itch here on my balls, and you look like a handsome fella. You think maybe like a little later on we can go by?" And I'm like, no, Sergeant. I'm responding to these questions. And he's going on and on about, you know, it's okay, it's a don't ask, don't tell. And then all of a sudden, Sergeant Instructor Staff Sergeant Taylor goes, "Oh, Staff Sergeant Gerard, Sergeant Lynch's dad is a general." And he goes, "Oh my God, is your daddy a general?" And it was. You see, that first night is they're gonna screw with everybody for hours and hours and hours. And the hard part is not laughing at the shit they're coming up with, right? Because it's hysterically funny. Because I had like five or six guys, or the sergeant instructors, because they'll come up and share into the light of the first night. All of them, they're asking me all these questions, and they're going on, and one of them screaming at you. And it's so funny, because, you know, you're looking to your left. Oh, because, you know, the staff, as they tend to be, were African-Americans, which in the OCS are either large and impossibly intimidating looking, or wiry and mean. And we had the wiry and mean version, and the guy standing right next to me was another African American. And when they got done with me, this is a half hour, and everybody's just staring straight ahead. He looked up and go, "Hey, brother, what's going on?" And this kid goes, "Sup?" So either. He's standing in a, I mean, at the end of the night, he's standing in a trash can going around in circles saying, rubber, rub, dub, I'm a Maytag watcher. And, I mean, and the whole runway looks, the whole barracks looks like a black, like a runway where jets are landing because we're running up and down, forming school circles to get instructions on how not to be a fag corpsman like the general's kid, that Lynch, who's going to get run out. Because they were on my ass for the whole first night. I forget for so long ago because when I told you the first time, I remembered some of the crap they were coming up with because it was hysterically funny. And you know, it's all you can do not to bust out laughing because it's so damn serious.
But do his kind of laugh and the way he used to say, oh, Doc Lynch.
Oh, Doc Lynch, you're killing me, Doc. Come over here. I got a little something for you to see. And my dad's in Norway. He arranges so he's got to come to D.C. around the time I graduate, right? So we go through the graduation. I'm walking over to see my dad. He's in uniform. And who's there but Gerard and Taylor? And they're laughing. And they're laughing their asses off. And I walk up, and my dad looks up and goes, oh, Doc Lynch. And I'm like, oh, for Christ's sakes, Dad. You got to be shitting me, man. Oh, yeah, he thought it was funny. They were apps. They told him everything. Oh, yeah, we messed with him like you wouldn't believe. The kid ain't bad. That's all I'm saying. Give him my dollar, Lynch, sir. Thank you.
So how old were you then, Tim, when you went through OCS?
I was 26 years old.
How old were you when you went through, Jeff?
I was 27. It was exactly 10 years after I went to Paris Island. I went in the late summer of 85.
83, I would have been 24 and a turn of 25, I think.
Yeah, I knew some of those guys. And matter of fact, the platoon commander for our platoon was the XO of a rifle company in 3-5 when I was there as the state platoon guy. So I knew him. His name is McCleskey, Captain McCleskey. And pretty good guys. So they fuck with me unmercifully, like the first couple days. But then after that, they'd say, Canada Kenny, march these fuckers to chow. Canada Kenny, get these fuckers set up. I just managed them, you know. So
yeah,
teach them how to click their rifles, i.e. teach them how to use WD-40, not fucking, shit like that, you know.
Yeah, I didn't know anybody. I was just another person in the green sea, man, who just trying not to get noticed.
Well, I went through OCS with Woody. He was in my platoon, you know, Chris Woodbridge.
Right.
And a couple other guys from the company. But it was I was a MESEP, so we went with the ROTC guys, you know, the Bulldog stuff in the summer.
Right. Oh, really, yes. Yeah. Timmy and I went through, right, in the winter. And, now Major General Timberlake was my platoon sergeant. My platoon sergeant. And, I want to see, we started in those old, squad bays at Brownfield, those old long squad bays. We started with 66 and we graduated 23.
Wow.
Yeah. That was, and that was before they had consolidated, right? The commands under, right? It was the recruiting command and then it was what? Training and education command owned OCS. And they didn't give a shit. Like, you don't send us good people, we're not putting them through. And that got fixed a few years later, I think. But at that time, like, imagine that. 66, right, officer candidate ship. We're in my platoon. And then we graduated 23. They were like,
they dropped on request, right?
Some they threw out. Some they dropped on request. I mean, they were leaving all the time. Hey, what happened to so-and-so? One of the guys was one of the L.L. Bean kids.
Mm.
Yeah, Kennedy Bean. He DOR'd. He made it to the 8th week, and then he said, I'm out of here. And but we were all older, you know, so going. So, but it's still, like Tim said, I mean, it's pretty intimidating. I don't think, in my life experienced hate like that, the way Timberlake hated me.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt the hate. You know, I remember, I tell the story, you know, you know how you could, on Sunday morning, you know, candidates have Sunday morning off, and so everybody goes to church, or just about everybody goes to church, and then I went to the chow hall to get something to eat, and, I walk in the chow hall, and there's nobody else in there, and who do you think is in the food line? who turns and looks at me. Timberlake had duty. He was OD, and he's there. And I'm like, fuck. And, right? But I'm through the door. There's nothing I could do. And so I look at him, and I say, good morning, Platoon Sergeant. And he looks at me and says, fuck you, McNarama. And I remember thinking, like, I never really associated those two salutations in my life before, but whatever. And so he gets his food, and he's looking at me, goes, Monday, have your DOR on my desk. I'm like, not going to happen, Sergeant, or Platoon Sergeant. And he said, you heard me. You know what I want. And I said, yes, Staff Sergeant. And so I got my food, and it might have taken me 3 bites to down 2 pancakes and some scrambled eggs. And then I drank all my juice, and I wiped my mouth, right? And I'm dumping my tray, and he looks up at me and says, leaving kind of quick, aren't you? I couldn't get out of that son of a bitch fast enough. And McNarama. So, and you want to know something? When I did post-traumatic winning at the General Officer Symposium, I was looking for Timberlake, but he wasn't there.
No.
I was going to say, is Major General Timberlake here? What's that?
Is he still in?
Yeah, he's still in. I was going to say, it never was McNarama, just for the record, okay? It was McNamara, always. But he wasn't there, so stole my line from me. Let's talk about Afghanistan. All Afghan talks are, what's our guy's name? Khalilzad says that, something like that.
Been there a few times.
Says that hopefully there will be a framework for an agreement by September 1st. We talked about this a few weeks ago. Our assessment was there's a lot of money that's got to have to be split up. You have the shadow Taliban governors or whatnot, and then you have the real people running it. That the consensus among us was that the Jorah would maintain control of the cities, and so let me ask you a fundamental question about this. Is there any way that they share power? Because your statements coming out of this thing are the people have never been the target of any of this, right? And you read that and you're like, bullshit, man. The people get whacked all the time. And it's not like it's an accident. Oh, we're aiming for the Americans, but we just blew up that village, right? We just blew up that hospital. You know, we know the Americans aren't in there, but the civilians were never the target. So is there any way... Jeff, is there any way they share power?
Well, I think what happens is there's an uneasy peace that where, just like you said, Jorah owns the big cities like Kabul and Jabed, Mazar-i-Sharif, Kandahar, Herat, you know, and so forth. They control the ring road that connects all those places,
right?
You know, and a couple others, and pretty much the outlying areas are still run by what we now call the Taliban, and eventually the Taliban guys they're in a position now that they weren't. The only difference is they're in a position now they weren't in before. I mean, down that Pashtun crescent that runs from, you know, the northeastern part of Afghanistan down through into Balochistan near the Iranian border in the west, is that it's dope. It's a huge the dope. Trafficking was always there, but now it's huge. And unlike it was, or at least legendarily it was during the 90s, you know, frowned upon by the Taliban, it's now embraced by them. It's how they finance themselves. So I think what will eventually happen, I mean, the optimistic way to look at it is for them, is that as the years go by, they'll have money. They'll send their kids to school. And those kids will come back, and, you know, in some kind of weird way, Afghanistan will progress. I don't think there'll be, I don't think there'll be like a major drive from the people in the outlying areas right now if this thing works that Khalilzad's talking about, to let's take everything.
Right.
I don't think that thing like happened in the 90s with the Taliban. You know, and that was the result of a lot of that back and forth between the warlords who were left after the Russians left. you know, fights between Hekmatyar and Masood and guys like that. Those guys are gone. And, you know, hundreds of thousands have been killed since then. So I think eventually that will happen. What I, you know, I think that's how it'll generally shake out. And really, it won't be too much different than it was through the, you know, from the 1920s when the Brits finally left. I mean, you know, they stopped coming in there until 1979 when the whole thing went to shit.
All right. Timmy, before you talk, let me read you, here's just a quote from one of the stories about the negotiations. And this is talking about freedom of the press, and also, and women, all right? We agree with the freedom of the press within the structure of the Islamic principles. We want it, and it is necessary for society because media monitors the veins of society like a physician and then recommends them a solution. But freedom of the press should respect the faith, and it should be used for the structure and the construction of society, not for destruction of individuals and society. Women have the right to get an education in line with the Islamic principles, and the media should be neutral. And right, so again, Tim, your thoughts. Can you exist with the Taliban? Can Jarrah and the Taliban coexist? Do you think this all comes together? Hello? Timmy.
Hey, I just heard you. I lost you for a second.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yep, go.
Okay, man. Yeah, the part about the women's right is interesting. But the thing with Afghanistan is that you've got these line ministries that run out of Kabul, education ministry, rural rehabilitation ministry, animal husbandry, women's affairs, et cetera. And they right now run – They are the ones that finance the schools and the agricultural things and whatnot, and they're right now kicking money down to schools in Taliban-controlled areas. So the governments, the Taliban and the whatever the government in Kabul is, they won't necessarily cooperate, but the way that Afghanistan is set up administratively, there's going to be a blending of the services, and I think what Jeff is talking about, which is eventually – people start to kind of come together to some type of a national norm because the Taliban are not popular. The government's not popular, but the people seem to be sick of fighting.
Yeah, honestly, I don't see how it works. I mean, to me, everybody's people are kind of sort of saying the right things, and people make comments like, look, when there's Taliban in this room sitting here with women who are not wearing burqas, that tells you that they've changed their position, that they're tired of fighting. And they may be tired of fighting, but how long will they be tired of fighting for? Until they say, hey, screw this. I am not playing this Western style, half Western, you know, half Islamic and all the rest of this nonsense. It's time to settle this thing once and for all.
I agree with you on that. They're not going to do that. I think the women in the, those areas are going to be treated, they're going to be just like they were before this whole thing started in the mid-70s. They're going to be back right there, you know, covered up. But the women up in the cities and stuff, they're going to be the way they were in the 70s. Mm-hmm. They're going to go back to the way, they're not going to, can't see the Taliban being all fired up to go in there and fight those big battles in the cities just to make sure that, you know, the women there are,
burgered up,
following Islamic law. Right. I mean, that's the best you can hope for. Now, what you're saying is they're not going to do that, and it's going to be Katie bar the door. We're
right.
Back to 1995.
Right.
Here we go, you know, bring out the arty, bring out the, right. you know, all the right. stuff we harvested from the Americans and the Russians and
right.
have
right.
at it again.
Right.
I hope that doesn't happen. I mean, that could happen. But
I don't see them as in any way, shape, or form as a Jeffersonian representative democracy that respects minorities. I don't.
No way.
Right?
But if that thing you read off was very prescient, it said all that was double talk for the women are going back in the
right.
world.
I agree with you.
You know?
And then again, and we'll compromise until one of us gets screwed really hard over money, and then it's going to be on again. I just don't see. I will be, you know, again, I would love to see some sort of compromise, you know, government where they learn to coexist. But that's not the way they do it. I mean, it's like saying that we want this, you know, this kind of Islamic represented government in Iraq. It's not the way they do it. They look at you when you talk about minority rights and, like, they don't even know who Tom Jefferson is. And they're like, what are you talking about? That's not how, who does that? Great countries don't do that. Great leaders don't do that, right? So, yeah, they will get out of the way. They always get out of the way. And, I mean, that was the Sunni argument to us. Look, we're on your side. We hate the Iranians. They're for the Iranians. They will be against you. You know that, right? Well, we don't know. We want everybody to work together. And No. Just get out of our way. We have always run this country. We will run it again. But just get out of our way, or maybe help us a little bit. And we'll take care of all of this. We'll be on your side. So.
You know what's the one difference is, the one unknown? That is that the genie of modernity has entered Afghanistan. You know, when back in 2008, 2009, when the MIT fab lab showed up in Jalalabad, you know, within a month you had 8, 9, 10-year-old girls and boys, segregated, of course, talking on the internet and whatnot with kids in Norway and South Africa and stuff like that. Those kids, this was a long time ago, they've come to maturity with an open kimono internet system, which is my new favorite word I got from Jeff. And we don't know what the genie of modernity is going to do to them socially, but it's doing something.
I agree with you. I agree with you, and that's powerful. Okay, are they willing to die for it though?
They're willing to kill for it, and they're willing to kill to stop it. So there'll be some orgies of blood.
But are they willing to die for it? They're willing to kill for it, but are they willing to die for it? And until you're willing to die for it, it's like the chickens. The chicken's involved in breakfast, the pig committed, you know, and so that's where, you know, are they committed? Are they at that point where they'll sign the John Hancock fuck you font?
No, they'll just leave.
Right, exactly. That's what I agree. I agree with that. And so to me, like, they like it, but not enough to die for it. And so we'll continue to coexist, and whoever takes over. So let's go around the table. Optimistic or pessimistic about Afghan peace? Jeff?
Peace is such a strange word to talk about with Afghanistan. I guess I'm optimistic.
Ooh.
I mean, I really think the... you know what, though? Let me double guard myself, because we haven't brought in the Pakistan-India thing.
Like, argue with yourself for a second. Timmy?
Okay.
Pessimistic. Nothing good and of long-lasting duration will happen until the problem of Pakistan is solved. It's Pakistan that's driving all the problems in Afghanistan. Until you solve that, It's going to be a festering sore.
I'm pessimistic, period. I do not believe that they can bite off successfully the compromise, because it's just not part of the way they live. Jeff, you're the optimist now.
The only thing I think is this, because of the fatigue of it, you know, that they'll reach an uneasy truce. I mean, it may blow up again because of...
So optimistic or pessimistic?
Optimistic, I guess.
There you go, optimistic.
Although those are false choices.
All right, let's talk about the CNO. The CNO-to-be resigned last weekend, and the Navy just nominated last night a cyber warfare guy. He's a 3-star, so they did not find what they wanted in the 4-star rank, so they reached down, and his name is Admiral Mike Gilday. So he's going to be the president's nominee. There was also a story in the news yesterday about the Air Force vice chief of staff to be. What's his name? His name is General John E. Hayton. And he was accused of sexual harassment. The Air Force looked into it and said that his nomination remains on track, according to the Pentagon. And but it was unclear whether he would be confirmed by the Senate at the end of July when outgoing Chairman Paul Silva is due to retire. Wait, so he's the head of Strategic Air Command now. Okay. All right, he's scheduled to become the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's what he's scheduled to be. So, I'm just curious, your thoughts on the turbulence that exists at high levels of the DOD, and that's A. B, the Navy continues to have a rough ride, and it doesn't look like it's going to get smooth anytime soon.
Well, I'll jump in first if you don't mind, Mac. I tell you this, the CNO, it's a commander, naval operations. He's the only member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who's actually a commander. That's a big job.
Okay, first of all, as O. Doc Lynch, it's the chief of naval operations.
Oh shit! Yeah, that's what I meant to say. But at any rate, my point being, it's a very narrow pipeline of guys of experience that you have to select with from that can hold that job. And right now, the Navy, it appears to me, is once again bending, or succumbing to congressional pressure over an issue which I think is bullshit. I think it's a matter of, I think we should have stood up on this one. The guy maintained a relationship with a former subordinate who got reprimanded over some kind of stupid naughty Santa skit. I don't see that as being an indication of bad judgment. But
okay, let me ask you this thing, because this is I interviewed Jeff Zulowitz. What if the relationship was professional, that the guy was told to go away, but what if Moran continued to consult him about professional issues? Is that different?
I do not think so. I don't see why. If the guy has some expertise and something useful to say, I think he absolutely can do that. What we're being asking these guys to be held to a standard of accountability that's unrealistic. And what I'm afraid is, and I want to read five lessons from this from the Commander Salamander blog, and he's been around for 15 years.
Right.
And this is what he says is the statement being sent to the Navy. This is what the message is. Number one, never live on base. Number two, there is no such thing as a Navy social event. They are all work events. Number three, never have more than one drink per hour at a Navy social event. Better yet, only have one drink, none if you can. Number four, show up on time, leave early. Number five, when deployed, be especially careful who is on your Liberty crew. The smaller, the better, if possible. If you are a male, do not include a female who has a DOD ID. If you have a female on your Liberty crew, see number two and four above. Boom. And that's it. I mean, that's the message the Navy is sending to its officers.
Now, that message wouldn't have worked, because if this guy, I mean, if they're saying that you can't even, they're infringing upon the Constitution here. You can't even have a relationship with somebody who's been convicted of pretty menial crime. I mean, it's going to be
He wasn't convicted.
He wasn't sexually harassing some women.
He wasn't convicted of anything. He was,
because you're not part of the ostracization crew.
Right.
You know, that if you're not totally against this guy, then you are totally condemned with him. That's a dangerous way to go for a representative form of government, even for their military. That means that if some people in Congress, or if some people, you know, in the higher echelons of the Pentagon say, this person is now persona non grata, he is denied bread or fire for 50 miles around the Capitol, and anyone who gives him that is condemned. I mean, that's bullshit. We don't do that stuff in America.
I think we do. I think we do, though.
We shouldn't do it, though.
Well, let me say this: the rules that Tim described, that Captain Salamander
Those are common sense rules.
Right, and they've been in effect for a long time. Right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, here's something for you. Those guys that were working for General Furness in Afghanistan, but they're actually in 3-5, who committed murder, were in the brig.
In Iraq. In Iraq, right.
They're in the brig in Camp Pendleton, and General Mattis went and had Christmas dinner with them. And he didn't say they were innocent. He didn't fucking stick up for them. He just went and spent Christmas Day with them. So what does that make? What does that mean that he should be, pilloried for that? You know, does that mean he's pro-war crime? Or does it mean, he took a look at the thing and he thought, hey, you know what? These guys have done wrong, but I'm gonna go visit them because, I feel like I should.
Well, then why wouldn't Moran, right? Why wouldn't Moran say I didn't do anything wrong? And even if I consulted him about, professional issues, he has something to add. And
that's a good point.
If he's got something to add, why wouldn't he? And again, the Freedom of Information Act has not been resolved, so nobody knows what's in the emails.
That's a good point.
Moran,
this, Mac, you and I both know, and so does Tim, we know general officers who hope they don't get promoted again, who hope that when you become a general officer, a lot of times, it's like Tiberius used to say about being the emperor. It's like you got a wolf by the ears. It's no joy. So maybe this guy Moran's like, heck with it. I'm sick of the baloney. I'm going to just leave. And then, that ends the whole thing right here.
Or did he have a say in it? In his withdrawal? We don't know.
Sounds like, from what Mac is saying, it sounds like he did. He didn't choose.
But again, he may have got a phone call from somebody on the Senate Armed Service Committee and said, is this true?
Yeah.
Because if this is true, I don't know that your nomination will get out of our committee. So, here's what I've heard. If any of that's true, then you should probably, who knows? I mean, if and when those emails become public, I guess we'll have the answer. But the fact that he didn't fight it, if he didn't do anything wrong, again, what do you make of that? Maybe you're right, Jeff. Maybe just say, hey, look. But when you're that close to being the CNO, if you believe that you didn't do anything wrong, then to me you would at least, let the Senate look into it and say, hey, look, I didn't do anything wrong. I mean, I've known him for 20 plus years.
Smart guy gives good advice.
Right. And I consulted him and I don't believe.
John Ellis, man. I mean, Pete Ellis, rather. The shit this guy used to pull. And, Lejeune said, this guy's worth, his juice is for the squeeze. He's got his shit together when he's not, hugging drunk, what I mean? Which is about every other day.
Think about the Chowder Society, right? Think about the stuff they did, after they were expressly told not to be up on the hill. What do? They took their uniforms off, they grew their hair out, and they went back, they went up there anyway because they were going to save the Marine Corps and got the shit written into law after World War II.
Yeah, but what does that, I've been hearing that since boot camp. The National Security Act, 1947. How is it with that three divisions and three air wings that was stipulated in that law? We went to Korea, we didn't even have two fucking regiments 2 years later.
We had, we had the standards, and it's written in the law. It wasn't funded. That's a different issue, though.
There's Hector Caporetto. You've never even been to boot camp mowing down, Chinese and shit.
Yeah. No, it's the Navy, they'll go through this, and then there's another trial coming out of the Gallagher thing in September. I mean, it's like every time you turn around a corner, they can't get out of their own way. The
fucking Jags are hungry, man.
What Timmy said about what Captain Salamander said, that's been going on in the Marine Corps for a long time. I mean, and people could say, well, that's not the way it should be. Let me just tell you this: nobody pays attention to the rebuttal after the accusation. If you're accused, your career is, I don't know that it's over, but it's a lot over. And so, We've all seen people go down, and then the result of that is the lessons you learn are never, ever be alone with a female Marine.
Right. And you said it before, when you're talking about, you know, they're always monkeying around the military because we have no protection against them.
Right.
And so it's prudent to do those rules that Commander Salamander said.
Right.
Because someone's always looking to make some hay off of you.
And Mike Pence is ridiculed for that, right?
Yeah.
He's ridiculed.
But on the other hand, if he wasn't like that, the mania against this guy who's in office now and the people who work for him is insane. Even worse than it was after Bush won the election, you know, because of the Florida stuff.
But I just
even worse than that.
We were talking before he came on the air, you know, I made the point that my father-in-law was a urologist, God rest his soul, and he would never be in a room with a female patient without a nurse in there, because simply the allegation you're putting yourself, your practice, and your family into a position
jeopardy.
And people can say, oh, that's ridiculous, and that's just, you know. Why would you know? You're making women feel uncomfortable. Well, I mean, look, it happened. So I don't think that's an abnormal response. And as much as people would like to say, oh, you know, I don't do that, and I'd always, you know, whatever. I don't know. Yeah, I just the whole the Admiral Moran thing. Clearly, I was like, holy shit, when I saw that headline. And then the same thing with the Air Force General Hyten, however you say, Hyten. I'm surprised that he survived that, and we'll see if he does. He has not been confirmed by the Senate, so we'll see if he does that. But you know what? There is no wiggle room on any of that. You better be squeaky clean when you go before the Senate, or you are gonna get annihilated in public. So let's talk about Ross Perot. I want to read a quote from the 1992 presidential debate, and talking about NAFTA. Right, Ross Perot just passed away, graduated the United States Naval Academy, self-made man. Mrs. Perot talking about NAFTA. We have to stop sending jobs overseas. It's pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element in making a car, having no environmental controls, no pollution controls, no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south when Mexico's jobs come up from a dollar an hour to $6 an hour, and ours go down to $6 an hour, then it's level again. But in the meantime, you've wrecked the country with these kind of deals. Was Perot right or wrong?
He was right, and I was wrong, so I didn't vote for him.
Timmy voted for him, though, right?
Yeah. Well, I've always been a political junkie, you know, I've always paid attention to politics. I don't know why. I don't anymore, but I used to when I was young. And what Perot was saying about the system being generally broken and not responsive and not adaptable has proven true. It's why we have Trump today, I believe, is that same damn reason. And that's the reason I voted for Trump this time, the same reason I voted for Perot.
He was a prototype, Yeah,
he wasn't a Washington insider. All these guys with their elite degrees and all this insider stuff, I mean, they have not done well by us in our lifetimes, pretty much, certainly since the 70s. And that's why a guy like Perot or a guy like Trump is appealing to somebody like me, because I know the experts. I don't trust them. I've had
years
with these people.
You spent one-tenth the time selling Perot that you did selling the Room of Pain. I would have voted for him. But here's the thing. The Room of Pain didn't need to be sold. It sells itself. It's like the single most good thing we did in those days. And who knew that was going to be that way? You know?
Yeah.
It goes on. You know, it's like the one bonding thing between all Marine officers. But I'll tell you, the Perot thing, I kick myself now. I'm look at that weird little guy with his fucking crew cut. Fucking after, you know, right? You know, he's like thinking the guy never said a wrong word. You know, you hear it now. You know,
absolutely. Yeah. He gave us Bill. He gave us Bill Clinton for 8 years.
Yeah. I mean, and his people say no. You know, really, it wasn't. But I think you're right. I think, you know, I mean, it's the one thing I. We had one of those mucus meetings over at the you know, the Marine Corps University Society, which we called mucus meeting, where we get to see, you know, General Van Riper and other folks. I was over there for one, so I met Donna Petit, and she was saying, she waxed eloquent on how Perot screwed us by, she was pretty convincing. I knew Bob Petit, but I never met her. And she did this little diatribe about how, and for those who are listening, Donna Petit was the captain of the Marine Corps at the time, and she testified in front of Congress on women and, you know, being more integrated in the services. She was kind of a darling at General Krulak, who became commandant a little bit later. But she was saying, she laid it out about how, you know, Trump took the type of votes that Perot took were the ones that would normally have gone to President George H.W. Bush, and so consequently we ended up with the draft dodging, grinning Lothario known as Bill Clinton, you know, that we had. But,
Well, you know, and again, you can probably argue that I don't understand when I hear people say, and that this quote reminds me of it. And I remember last fall hearing Orrin Hatch, conservative Republican from Utah, say when the president was talking about putting tariffs on China, right? China, who tariffs the shit out of our stuff, right? And so President Trump is saying, you know, I'm gonna tariff their goods if they don't come to the table, if they don't negotiate, if we don't get these barriers dropped. And Orrin Hatch said, look, this worries me. I'm a conservative. I'm for free trade. And you're going, you gotta be shitting me, man. This is not free trade. And so you look at the argument Perot makes. What did they expect to have happen to the American middle class, right? And when all these jobs go away, where are you going to make these jobs up?
Yeah.
And the answer is we haven't. And you've seen, you know, you used to have a union job and union benefits and quality health care. You know, now everybody struggles with that. You know, you used to have a defined benefit retirement plan. Now you got a 401k. And I know people write in and say, oh, no, if you contribute every year to the 401k, blah, blah, it's so much better. Yeah, but most people don't because they're not making enough money and they're trying to raise their kids. And so they don't kick. And so now when you get to the end of your life, it's like, well, honey, I'll work at Burger King and you work at Chick-fil-A. You can have Sundays off, and I hear it's a really good place to work.
And if you talk to average people in California and you say, was Cesar Chavez a pro-immigrant guy? He was anti-illegal immigrant for precisely the stuff you just said. He's a union guy, but he was for, you know, legal union people who are here legally. You know, he was a dead set against that, you know, and he, I don't know if he was even, he might have been passed away by the time all this shit happened with NAFTA. You know, I'm not good on that part of history, all those guys were like, holy Christ, you know, we're going to get screwed on this deal. And you wonder about guys like Jesse Jackson in that case and Al Sharpton are supposed to be so, you know, such emblems of, you know, the black community. That's who gets hurt the worst, you know, in this deal, in that type of thing, in NAFTA, you know.
So when you see these guys and you're looking at the American economy at the macro level saying, okay, it's done this, you know, how do we create jobs?
Is it because of donors that this happens, or what?
Well, I don't know. But when you're just looking at analyzing the effect of NAFTA, right, and you're watching all those factories go to Tijuana. I remember I knew people that were, you know, doing business in Tijuana. They said Tijuana is like Sacramento in 1849, man. That thing is booming like you cannot even believe. Like, all those border towns are going crazy because of the building that is going on there, the factories that are going down there, because every one of those American manufacturers are saying, fuck the EPA, fuck OSHA, right? Fuck Social Security, right? All that cash is now going into our pocket, right? This is awesome. And then we're not even going to be taxed when we yank it back in the United States. This is awesome. So, you know, it's I don't understand how you don't protect it. I don't understand and expect to sustain the middle class, which has made this country what it is.
I mean, and you know, I don't want to be paranoid, but like it seems like the obvious answer is because someone's paying them not to. You know what I mean? When you talk about
everybody on the take,
who's the guy you brought up? Senator
Orrin Hatch.
Yeah, Orrin Hatch. You know, I mean, this is a guy. He always thought the guy was kind of a straight shooter. I mean, maybe he was being straight, but I'm
well, how can you be straight when you say that?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, what are you talking about? People who voted for you are losing their jobs, or is there someone else voting?
I'm for free trade. Well, what we have with China is not free trade, Orrin.
No.
Yeah, I don't get it. But so yeah, Ross Perot, Bill Clinton. Wait, I had one more thought I wanted to do, but it must have been a lie because I forgot that. To me, you have anything else you want to throw in about Ross Perot?
Well, not necessarily about Ross Perot, but as we're talking about the consequences of this NAFTA stuff and whatnot, I don't know if you guys have ever had to deal with OSHA regulations, but you want to talk about a pain in the ass and an expensive pain in the ass that virtually most industries, most of the rules are virtually ignored. It certainly makes doing business very difficult. You know, I mean, technically in the United States, if a guy's on the back of a trailer, a flatbed trailer, loading that trailer, he is supposed to have a fall resistant restraining device on because he's above 4 feet off the deck. Yeah. That's OSHA rules.
Right.
4 feet off the deck, you're supposed to have a harness on and some kind of life support system.
And that adds costs to your bottom line.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
The price of what you're selling is going up, and we do that. And let me tell you, I didn't deal with OSHA. I saw OSHA when I was on the Ranger, and when we'd be in port, right, all those contractors would come on, and you'd be talking about, you know, they were trying to make some repair to adjacent to a nuclear weapons base, and you'd be talking like, well, okay, you can do this, you can do this, and then they'd say, oh no, well, we can't do that, and we can't do that. Like, why not? Well, OSHA this and OSHA that, and we can only do this for X number of hours, and then we're gone for this period of time, and you're like, holy shit, man.
It's
pretty amazing in the ship business, all the requirements. But I've always thought, like, so you don't have any of that, right? All of our producers do, and we're going to let you bring your product into our country. And then there's the Chinese who subsidize their product, and then when we say, yeah, we're not going to let that product in, they dump it into Argentina, who then ships it to the United States, and that's how they get it here. And it's like we're not smart enough to figure that shit out.
But there's another consequence to it, though, too. When's the last time you saw somebody roofing? You ever see roofers working on houses or apartments nearby?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Ever seen them with harnesses on?
Oh, no, never.
Never, right? That right there is somebody who's not OSHA compliant, ooh, which means that they're probably low bid on the job, which is why they're doing the job. I very rarely see anybody with OSHA compliant roofers either. Because if you're OSHA compliant, putting on a roof, which is expensive enough, now got real damn expensive. Because you've got to park equipment out there that serves as a basis to put your lifelines on. So if you fall off the roof, something stops you. So okay.
Riddle me this. We got about 10 minutes left. This is a current events question. What is the one of the primary purposes of the census?
The census is to align the government.
Timmy?
No, it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with representation. What the hell is it for? Shit! I give up. It's not how they define representation.
Well, how do they define representation?
I think it is.
I mean, how do you know?
I don't know. I heard somebody smart saying that wasn't it, but I wouldn't listen to what the hell he was saying. I don't know how they do that, but I don't think it's every 10 years. They don't start doing the gerrymandering every 10 years. They gerrymander constantly.
The information from the census is used to get a broader sense of the population general.
Right.
right? This information then is used to calculate the number of seats in each state that each state will have in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Oh, okay.
And so it's used to
asking for citizens. The word is out there that we have 11 million illegals. But if we have more than that, and my sense is we got a lot more than that, and there are a couple of states, i.e. California, although they could be in a shitload of states, but California is one that leaps out at you, then maybe there's more districts in California than there needs to be, because there's a lot more people who don't deserve, who should not be here, because they're here illegally. They're not here on visas, they're not here.
Okay,
here
if one of the primary purpose is to apportion seats from the U.S. House of Representatives,
right,
how do you not ask the question?
And we always ask the question until a couple years ago.
So the question then, when we didn't ask the question, okay, so now to put it back on, it's purely political and motive, right? So you guys know me, I believe that both sides of the aisle operate on the same set of rules, and they're the same people, they just believe in different shit. So when the question wasn't asked, do you think that was politically motivated as well?
Absolutely.
I absolutely it was. But nothing got said because everybody loves Barack Obama. Now, when you actually look at it and say, so if the census is used, either its primary or secondary purpose, one is to find out, right, the population of the nation, you know, and then another one is to apportion revenue that's allocated per capita, you know, and then a third one is to, you know, draw the lines for the U.S. House of Representatives. So if that's the purpose of it, how do you not ask the question? Because if what you're doing is you're weighing parts of the country that have illegal citizens in it and giving them a greater voice than other parts of the country.
And you're right. And they ask other questions that are ridiculous. How many toilets do you have in your house? I mean, how many, you know, all these other things are asked.
So I don't understand. I don't even understand the basis of the discussion if it's used to define political power and districting in the country. I don't understand. How do you not ask the question?
You got to ask. I mean, you know, the only other way you can tell is to actually make people present credentials at the polls, and we know
if it's to district the nation for the House of Representatives, how do you not ask the question?
Right. And it makes you wonder, why is it only every 10 years then? With the dynamism of, you know, immigration and illegal immigration stuff, why isn't it every 5 years? Things change quick now, way quicker than they used to.
Tim, any thoughts? Why, if that's one of the primary reasons?
Anachronism, right?
What does anachronism mean?
It means it's something it's something that was made sense way back in the day and served a purpose, but it no longer serves a purpose now because technology has overtaken its essential mission.
So what's an anachronism? The census?
Yes. Social Security Administration can cook up a much better data than you're going to get off that census.
But not who's a citizen. Not if they don't say.
What the hell does that matter? We're apparently not going to ask that question anyway.
No, the administration knows that they're permanent aliens.
Not going to fill in the census. So where you have like a shitload of people in California before who answered the census in 2010, if this question's on there, they're not going to answer. They're not going to answer the census at all.
All I'm saying is I don't even think we need to take a census anymore. I think we've got that information in other ways that are available to us. The census now becomes, I mean, wasn't it in the past something that the guys in power could give like jobs to people to go door to door and it was almost just a patronage. It was like a patronage, type of operation.
They came to Quantico when I was there, and then they came to Rocky Court up in Housing and Onifred. a person came to the door and did your census.
Right,
they get paid for that. So it's a little bit of an important thing.
It's part of the Constitution, man.
Yeah, and the Constitution says it never occurred to them there'd be an illegal problem. And so they say just population, right? But every other country almost, every other particularly representative democracy asks, are you a citizen? In the UN, it says, you know, when you do a census, you should ask if they're a citizen of that country. All these common organizations that the Democrats love, all, you know, outside of
well,
America,
I mean, this is, I, to me, it's like, it's like you understood, right, in English, in English grammar. So we're going to use this to apportion the nation so our government functions.
Right.
And in that apportionment, we're going to account large, we're going to count large numbers of non-citizens as, no, we can't.
No,
so, it,
can't.
I mean, look, I just don't, if that's the purpose, right, to apportion the nation for the House of Representatives, then how do you not ask the question, are you a citizen? Because you're not a citizen then the line isn't going to change here. It's still what it was. I don't understand why, and again, I would describe the same political motives for dropping the question, for not including it in the 2010 census, right? As I would for including it in 2020. But to me, you know, it was politically motivated, and maybe it might be politically motivated now by the president, but I don't see, in terms of truth, how do you apportion the nation appropriately if you don't know the number of citizens?
I mean,
to what's
apportion? Your argument against it? That's the
what's
that's
that?
The, what would be an argument? Not
well, the one I hear most is you're not going to get a valid count of the population because when they're asked, are you a citizen, they will say no and they'll stop answering questions. So
yes,
you're going to have this percentage of people that you can't account for. Now, if I'm a Democrat and I think that I can get those people to vote Democrat, right, then what I say is, hey, it's really important to have a better count. And districting be damned, we need to know who's here. We need to know our demographics. That's more important. If I'm a Republican, I say, no. We need the appropriate count. If I believe in the truth, I think I say the Constitution says we use this to district the nation. We district the nation by U.S. citizens, right? If you're not a citizen, you don't count in this tally. I'm sorry.
You may be here legally. And that's okay. And if you had children who were born here because of stupid 14th or whatever amendment is, I think it's 14th, then they're citizens. But you don't get to vote, and you know that gets brought out. I am a legal resident of the United States, but I'm not a citizen. Why would you not? If that's who you were, why would you not put that on?
You would if you were
if you were illegal, you wouldn't put it on.
Right.
And then so the
argument is, in order to get better numbers of the census, we don't ask that question. And, oh, by the way, right, those districts are going to gain seats and power in that part of the country that has, right, illegal parts of the population that get counted in the census. So
you can't have illegal people living in America with impunity.
But there's another thing that I'm seeing about this that's kind of happening, because we're assuming that heavily Democratic areas are going to have an increase in the numbers because there are going to be more illegal aliens living in those areas, because that's generally where they tend to be. Like here in Texas, I mean, I'm in the one part of Texas that's solidly Democrat, always has been, but the migrants aren't staying here, brother. They're being bused inland, and I think you're going to find a lot more migrants in a lot of places that have traditionally not had high levels of Hispanics.
I mean, large cities are the magnet because they have, you know, they can, you know, there's jobs. Right, they can go and work, there's support in those cities. There's social programs and in those cities that they can take part of. So those are the magnets.
Yeah, I mean, so you got the big cities run by Democrats, New York, Chicago,
right,
L.A.,
right,
and
right.
They're disasters. You got real rich people, you got dirt poor people who are working illegally, basically as slaves to them. And everybody who isn't moves out to the, you know, like I'm fixing to do, you know, move out of this state because it's, you know, crazy here and getting worse, and move to a place that's more user-friendly, taxes-wise and stuff like that.
Right.
And so now you got a country where you have these big mega metropolises where you got rich people and you got slaves.
Well, slaves might be overstating it, but you certainly have a large gap in the wage in the wage scale between those two. Right?
Yeah, there's no push by the and then there's Republicans who want slaves too. You know, I mean. You know, they like the cheap labor thing. I mean, let's face it. You know, the there's been a conspiracy between the two, like an unsaid conspiracy.
We've never gone down that. We've never chartered that black helicopter before.
Well, I mean, no. What I'm saying is not. You always blow up in that baloney about black helicopters, man. It's just this. There's been a conspiracy. I mean, maybe not a spoken conspiracy, but there's been benefits to having illegals here on both sides of the aisle. Why would the Bushes be so, you know, soft on illegal immigration? That jerk Jeb. Oh, you know, illegal immigration is really an act of love with this stupid look on his face. You know, and all the Democrats, of course, you know, they think they're all going to vote for that. If finally, you know, the fatigue takes hold, we just say, yeah, just legalize everybody, pass citizenship. And they'll all be voting for the Democrats then. And the Republicans, you know, a lot of their donors and stuff, they like cheap labor and stuff. It's, you know, and so there's a kind of a, you know, there's a large, powerful part of the community that gains benefit from illegal people crossing the border and working at low wage, lower than minimum wage, basically illegal wage.
There's no doubt about that.
No, you're right about that. If that's the unspoken, conspiracy, then there is validity.
It's not like, hey, let's get together and fuck right. over, you know, illegals and, you know, poor Americans.
No, it's just in our interest, right? It's in,
right.
On one side, it's on our economic interest. On the other side, it's their political interest. So we just.
These Koch brothers, they love, you know, undocumented workers, as they would say, coming in. And they used to be Republican, you know, the biggest Republican donors.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting. You know, my oldest daughter, Megan, went over to Australia and graduated, and she's a lawyer now, and she lured her brother and sister over there, right? And so my two youngest went over to Australia, but they're on this, they've got to get a job and spend X number of months working in the agricultural industry in order to stay in Australia, right? So my son was working in a chicken plant, and my daughter was working in a winery in like South Australia. And I'm asking, well, what do you do? Well, it's menial labor. I'm like, well, what are you getting paid? $17 an hour. I'm like, what? How does anybody afford food there? And I don't know, but the wages that they pay the itinerant agricultural help in Australia. You can live comfortably here in America, and they don't live comfortably at those wages overseas, and that's the lesson. You either get the cheap farm labor, or you pay through the nose for that damn food. And that's something we don't want to
chicken,
do.
And your daughter gets free wine, and they just trade with each other.
Oh, you and me can have fun in Australia, my friend.
Wine and chicken, you can't beat it.
Yeah, but that's interesting because that's what happens when you pay people a wage that they're willing to do the work at. You know, you keep on hearing from like the meat packers and stuff like that. I can't get Americans to do this job. No, you're not paying enough of a wage to get Americans to do the job. That's two different things. So Australia is a pretty good example of a country that doesn't have cheap immigrant labor, and it's what's the most expensive city in the world? Melbourne, Australia. That's what
really?
You get.
Is it?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Melbourne's horribly expensive.
Wow.
Yeah.
The only place I ever was is in Brisbane. That's an interesting one. Melbourne, I didn't know that.
All right, boys, any final comments about Afghanistan, Ross Perot, being alone with a woman, the census, any final comments, Jeff?
Well, right now, I would never be alone with a woman in Melbourne if she was Afghan Taliban you know, wearing a burqa. So in other words, no, I don't have any more thoughts.
Jimmy, any final thoughts on a whirlwind hour of brilliant discourse?
No, I think that Ralph that Perot was prescient, and I think had he been asked, he would have said, avoid all land wars in Asia, which is prescient, and never be alone in a room with a woman subordinate. Prescient yet again. We missed a true superstar when we let Ross Perot not get elected. It's a damn shame.
Admiral Stockdale is vice president. Ralph.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Right. The Trump nominee to be the CNO is a former surface warfare officer. He is currently the director of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he is formerly the CO of the 10th Fleet and also the United States Navy's Cyber Forces.
What's his name?
His name is Mike Gilday, G-I-L-D-A-Y. Yeah, he looks like he's never been alone with a woman in his life, so he should sail right through. Anyway, boys, always a pleasure to visit with you two. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
You bet. Goodbye.
Thank you.
There you have it. Tim Lynch, Jeff Kenny here. We bid goodbye to O-Doc Lynch, so you heard the rest of the story. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How about that for an entertaining program? Yeah. I was pretty geeked up earlier today talking about a report that came out from the Center for Strategic International Studies by a retired Marine colonel by the name of Mark Kansian. And so while that was playing, I shot him an email. He called me and said, I'd love to come on. So you're going to get a chance to hear him deep dive on the report that he issued. And it's entitled, Tell Me How This Ends, Military Advice, Strategic Goals, and the Forever War in Afghanistan. So I'm looking forward to that. So, you're also going to hear from a guy I talked to yesterday, a guy named a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel. By the name of Jack Matthews. So Jack talks about how alcohol can destroy your life. And I heard him after we came back from Afghanistan. And he's a pretty interesting guy. So you'll hear him next week too. Also trying to track down the squad leader. And who won the Super Squad competition for the 2nd Marine Division. So we'll get him on, find out what he's got to say. Here's an email about the census, Mac. I think if you assign the same motive to both sides, that is to seek political advantage through the execution of a sentence, I keep saying sentence, through the execution of the census, all this kind of fits into the appropriate lens. Why would the Obama administration not included? Well, certainly because of their humanity, but right behind that would be their political desires to impact areas in which their constituents who might be in the country illegally live. Expand those numbers, expand those districts, expand their power. And I think as consistently, you could see the Republicans pushing back on that. And in that light, it's kind of funny actually, in that light, it becomes humorous that somehow or other the Trump administration is accused of something the Obama administration was not. Add the media's hate for Mr. Trump, and I think you can see why you have a perfect storm. I'm not really sure I understand the Supreme Court as the arbiter of the reason why the question either appears that or does not appear. I think everybody knows who pays any attention that it's normally about money or some other form of political power. This certainly is that. But quite honestly, if you're after the truth, which I think I heard you say, it has to start with some kind of factual counting of U.S. citizens if that's going to be linked to power politically in the country. I think that's right. And I didn't start out at this position either. Interesting discussion. I have yet to hear any of the talking heads discuss the reason why the Obama administration did away with the question. Well done. I'm not sure that I paid attention. I think I've heard it, but I don't know that I heard any good explanation for it anyway. Anyway, that will do it if you're just tuning in. A whole bunch of news. Marine Corps got a new commandant. That's right. Effective this morning at the ceremony started at 09, so sometime between 9 and 10 o'clock. The colors of the Marine Corps were transferred between Bob Neller and David Berger. So fair winds and following seas to General Neller, and all the best of luck to General Berger as he commences his tenure as the Commandant of the Marine Corps. So good luck to you, sir. And if you're just tuning in, there's a whole bunch of news. A three-star was nominated to be the CNO. We'll talk about that. A whole bunch of other stuff. So don't touch that dial. The Iranians behaving poorly in the Straits of Hormuz. That's nothing new, but another chapter written. And the British Navy, the Royal Navy. That's right. Once again, right, doing good things on the high seas. So congratulations to them. So don't touch that dial. Interesting show today. You get to hear about Colleen and me going to have a public transportation adventure today. Yeah, no kidding. So have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow on a historic Thursday when the Marine Corps welcomes a new commandant. Have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and out.